Cathcart Robbins was half of a Hollywood power couple. She worked as a publicist and was PTA president at her kids' prestigious private school. Her then husband, an actor and director, eventually became the CEO of Paramount Pictures and Nickelodeon. However, behind the glitz and glamour of the red carpet premieres and extravagant dinner parties, Laura was keeping a secret.
I was just always anxious. I was shaky. Like, I was so exhausted, and I was not myself. I wasn't the kind of mom I wanted to be at all. I wanted to have energy and be generous and playful, and I couldn't be any of those things because I was so tired. My kids were bedwetters, and like I said, they were born back to back. They woke each other up in the middle of the night. And because my husband was shooting most of this time, the logistics were up to me. So it was a 24/7 job. And I just reached a breaking point, and my doctor prescribed Ambien for me, which turned out to be a lifesaver.
At first, it did seem like a lifesaver. Little did she know that this seemingly innocent solution would eventually lead her down a dangerous path.
I took it as prescribed for the first year. And then I took it pretty much as prescribed the second year, but occasionally I would take like another half to fall asleep. The third year I was taking 1.5 regularly to fall asleep every night, and then taking like another half in the middle of the night. By the sixth year, the year that I write about and stashed my life in hiding, I'm taking 10.
While Laura hid her secret for years, she eventually sought help. Now she's speaking out to help others struggling with substance use disorder. I'm Angela Kenneke. This is Grieving Out Loud. Prepare yourself for a fascinating conversation that promises to inspire and empower. It's an episode you won't want to miss.
Well, Laura, welcome to Grieving Out Loud. I am so excited to have you here. I read your book, Stash, My Life in Hiding, from cover to cover. I really could not put it down. I think that's the best compliment a writer could get, right?
It is indeed. Thank you so much, Angela. Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I don't know if excited is the right word that denotes like some kind of joyousness, but I'm really curious for our conversation and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I think we can live through a lot and we can experience a lot of suffering, a lot of issues in our lives, but there's still room for that joy, right? There's still an appropriate place to celebrate the success.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, the success of you putting your story on paper and how well your book is doing. So for sure, joy is the right word, I think.
Yes.
One of the things I found so fascinating, I want to talk a little bit about your background, but I found the way you described addiction so fascinating. And I learned things that I didn't really know about addiction. And so thank you for that.
Yeah. I mean, the choice to kind of write this active first person so that you were in my head with me was intentional, because it's really difficult to imagine, even for me, what must be going through the head of someone who makes the choices that I did. And why would anybody who has a life that looked like mine make these choices that takes you further and further away from being able to, one, enjoy that life or even just live that life? And so I wanted to make sure that you understood what was going on in my head with me. And so that hopefully there is more empathy for the next person who may be going through what I went through in 2008.
Right. Because on the outside looking in, it appeared that you had this fairy tale life. I mean, really, you were living the American dream.
Laura's journey is a modern day rags to riches story. Her childhood had its share of trauma.
I mean, really, truly, you know, I grew up poor, very interesting kind of poor. Like, we were welfare poor, but I went to private schools and we always lived in middle class neighborhoods. So I didn't really know how poor we were, but I also had an abusive stepfather who was emotionally abusive. And I qualify that. I'm not even sure why I do that. It wasn't physical abuse, and I'm not trying to diminish the abuse I had, but I want to just allow people to see what I was living with and why I think it was tolerable for as long as it was. So I came from that. I came from a world where there was violence in my house. There was yelling. So my whole existence was about making the yelling stop, basically.
Do you think that the root of your addiction started in that trauma in childhood?
Yes, but I think it started with me departing from my authentic self because it rubbed my stepfather the wrong way, and that editing of myself. I don't think that there was a need for something outside myself that I need like I couldn't extinguish then, but I certainly think I built the scaffolding for it so that by the time the addiction found me, which is how I like to put it, I was ripe for it.
Yeah, something outside yourself. It's also interesting how you dropped out of school and experimented with some drugs and then sort of got away from that and managed to build this fabulous career for yourself.
Yeah. And the career was, it was a PR company in Hollywood in the late 1990s. So I was fortunate with that. I had a knack for, I'm a voracious reader, always read the papers. Like back then there were actual physical newspapers and physical magazines. Sure. And I read all those anyway. And for a publicist, it's really necessary, or it was then. And so it was just like, oh, I already do all this and I can write. So I can write that release and that bio and write this letter of whatever. And, you know, I know the journalists from what they write. So it was just, it was an easy transition for me, even without an education, without a formal education. And there weren't any Black PR firms in Los Angeles during that time. I was the only one. What happened was I got all of the labels and the studios. They came to me to market their urban projects, which is code for Black. It was then, it still is.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to do, like, when DreamWorks hired me, I wasn't doing, you know, their big projects, but I was doing their Black films and the Black TV. Same for the labels. Like when Sony or Universal hired me, I was doing the hip hop stuff, but I wasn't doing their mainstream. But it was a niche and I filled it.
In addition to succeeding at a very high-profile competitive job, Laura also met and fell in love with a Hollywood heavyweight. Her now ex-husband, Brian Robbins, was an actor, director, and filmmaker. He now is president and CEO of Paramount Pictures and Nickelodeon.
I actually met him at the supper club that I worked at on Friday nights. He and his castmates would come in after rap on Fridays. And so I saw him there. I don't think he remembered me. He didn't pay any attention to me. But he saw me out at dinner one night during this time and kind of fastened on to me and left without having said a word to me, but asked the maitre d' to come bring me to the phone from his car. And I was like, I knew who he was because I knew him from television. And that was kind of our first time we spoke, was him verifying where he knew me from.
And he's a director producer in Hollywood.
He was, yes. Right. He was a director producer then. He was mainly a director. Actually, he was an actor director then. He was still on a TV series at that point.
And he kind of sweeps you off your feet and there's this whirlwind romance.
Yes. Yes.
And during all this time, you weren't relying on substances then, were you?
I wasn't. I was drinking socially, but nothing out of the ordinary, nothing that set me apart from my peers. I actually don't and never did really like alcohol. So that wasn't like a problem. And I wasn't doing drugs because I was a publicist on the West Coast, which meant I had to be up hours before everybody else because I was on East Coast time with most of my clients. There just wasn't time, but it also wasn't a draw for me.
But at some point you were having trouble sleeping, right? And that's where the Ambien comes in.
It is. After I got married and after both my boys were born back to back, one in 98 and one in 99, I was just like a walking live nerve ending. I was short tempered. I was just, I can't even, it, actually what I felt like then was how withdrawal felt to me later when I would go into like a detox, when I would stop taking the Ambien. I was just always anxious. I was shaky. Like I was so exhausted and I was not myself. I wasn't the kind of mom I wanted to be at all. I wanted to have energy and be generous and playful. And I couldn't be any of those things because I was so tired. My kids were bedwetters. And like I said, they were born back to back. They woke each other up in the middle of the night. And because my husband was shooting most of this time, the logistics were up to me. So it was a 24/7 job. And I just reached a breaking point and my doctor prescribed Ambien for me, which turned out to be a lifesaver.
Do you think you had some postpartum depression as well? I mean, looking back, do you know?
Yeah, I absolutely thought that I did. What I think now, and I was never diagnosed with anything, so I don't know what I had, but what I think now is that my symptoms weren't really of depression. They were of postpartum anxiety. And I didn't have that language then. So I didn't know how to properly articulate.
Yeah, nobody had that language then.
Yeah.
My Emily was born in 97. You know, nobody was talking right. about those kinds of things, really.
No.
At that point, until someone famous came out and talked about it. Was it Brooke Shields?
Right.
Yeah.
It might have been Brooke Shields. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
After Brooke Shields gave birth in the early 2000s, she suffered from postpartum depression. At that time, people didn't really talk openly about this condition because they were afraid of judgment and backlash, a fear that tragically came true for Shields. Even actor Tom Cruise publicly criticized Shields, saying she was dangerous for spreading irresponsible misinformation about chemical imbalances of the brain.
Yeah, and coupled with that, I was ashamed of feeling the way that I was. I really thought that a good mother would just be better. And so even though I asked my doctor about it, I did it very timidly and I didn't give him much evidence of what I was going through. I was really hoping he would just say, no, you're not, but here's what's going on and you'll get over it, basically. I wasn't honest with him. I wasn't honest about everything that I was experiencing.
So the Ambien really helped you. But then I didn't know or I haven't heard of people being addicted to Ambien before or taking it during the day. That kind of shocked me because how could you function taking Ambien during the day?
Well, I took it as prescribed for the first year. And then I took it pretty much as prescribed the second year. But occasionally I would take like another half to fall asleep than the one pill that was prescribed to me. The third year, I was taking 1.5 regularly to fall asleep every night and then taking like another half in the middle of the night. By the sixth year, the year that I write about in Stash My Life in Hiding, I'm taking 10, which is an incredible amount of Ambien. Most of those, I would say 8.5 of those pills were at night. So I would take like 4 to get to sleep. And then I would wake up twice and I would take more each time I woke up. Wow. And during the day, I wasn't taking like a whole pill, but I would break off pieces of a pill just to keep myself from going into withdrawal. It was not nearly enough to put me to sleep. In fact, by that point, I couldn't sleep without Ambien and alcohol. I had to boost it with vodka and occasionally boost that with Benadryl. So the Ambien itself wouldn't have put me to sleep at that point.
And you said earlier, alcohol wasn't really your thing.
Right. But it was very useful in this. So, you know, I didn't drink when I didn't have Ambien, but I always, at the end, I drank almost every time I took an Ambien.
Wow. And I know some things happened in the book. We won't give all of the book away. I know some things happened that were kind of a wake-up call that got you to seek help. But I thought what was so interesting was the way you described addiction and the way you felt in your own life. In fact, I even wrote down something you wrote. And I want you to kind of talk about this a little bit.
Yeah.
You felt like there was a plexiglass wall between you and everybody else. That was so interesting. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. And I don't know that that was specific to the addiction. And I think this was part of the scaffolding for it, which was that I had lived in such a way where I was vulnerable with no one, not truly vulnerable. There were people who knew me on a more intimate level than others. But I was never really truly vulnerable. I never revealed all of the things that were so difficult for me, especially in motherhood. Like, I just did not know how to be a mom. I certainly didn't know how to do it the way that other people were doing it. And it seemed to come naturally to them. So this wall that I had up, which was plexiglass, meant people could see me. And I looked good. You know, I was the Parent Association president. I'd just been asked to join the board. I was attending premieres. I was playing tennis. I was working out. Like, all of this was happening right up until the time that I checked myself into treatment. But behind the wall, this plexiglass wall, I was dying. I was miserable. I was confused. I was bewildered. I was ashamed. And it was about the addiction, but it wasn't specific to it necessarily because I was ashamed about that postpartum anxiety, which is what I think it was. I was really ashamed. I was humiliated by that. Like, what's wrong with me as a mom that I can't be effortless, that I can't get this cheerfully, that I can't be joyfully walking my kids into their classroom instead of like yelling at them and pulling, running back for the stuff I forgot in the car. And I didn't want anybody to see that. I thought it felt like survival to me, which is what my childhood felt like, you know, edit and survive, don't edit and die. And that's what it felt like to me then, even though intellectually I knew that it wasn't, but I couldn't metabolize that. It just felt like that.
It's interesting to me, keeping up the front of this life, all the things that you were doing where nobody would have really guessed, right? Most people wouldn't have guessed. And the same thing happened with my daughter, who started with weed and Xanax and graduated to heroin. She was planning on running a half marathon. And I think of how inconsistent that is, you know, with using something so harmful to your body.
Yes. You know, for me, while I was still managing it, there was just like just on the other side of this, right? Like every night I went to got ready for bed thinking, I'm only going to take them as prescribed tonight. I'm going to wake up tomorrow. I'm going to enjoy that workout. Like I was getting through everything, but I was dragging myself through everything, even though it didn't look like that. And so each night I went to bed with good intentions and these ideals for my life about what I wanted my life to look like. But then the addiction would take over. And it all went to the wind. There's that really beautiful Robin Williams. I don't know if it's beautiful, actually, but it's a really fitting Robin Williams quote where he says, I was compromising my standards faster than I could lower them. And that's what it was like for me.
Yeah, I do think that the way the brain is taken over by the drug and physically your body, too, like nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to take 8 to 10 Ambien. Nobody's thinking, oh, this is a great thing I'm doing or using heroin or whatever it might be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a part of you that's still you and knows, but that other part, I think, just takes over in such a strong way. And that really hit home for me when you talked about getting ready to go to rehab. And I guess this is the part, because I haven't suffered from substance use disorder, that I don't understand is like, you know, you have a problem. You're going to rehab, but you're plotting how you're going to take drugs and alcohol into rehab with you. Like, why go to rehab? That's what or even when you were coming out, you were still, even though I applaud you because you did not do it, but you were trying to figure out how you could go back to it, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I, you know, my editor and my agent both, neither of them have had much experience with addiction. So they read that piece that you were talking about and they were both like, what? And so, you know, the answer is that I knew how bad it was going to be for me. I knew how all of this stuff, you know, that I did, all this hiding, all this stashing away, not just the drugs, but pieces of myself, was really because of one primary fear. This is what I've discovered for myself. And that's a fear of discomfort. In this case, I'm talking about physical discomfort, but there's also just being uncomfortable in a situation, any situation, and I don't want to do it. So I'll avoid that at all costs, or I did up until when I got sober. So, you know, it just seemed logical to me that they weren't going to give me enough drugs to keep me comfortable in treatment. I did my research, you know, as much research as you can do in 2008. And I decided that, one, I would have to lie about how much I was taking. I would need to take more so they would give me more drugs to taper me off. I don't think I put that in the book, but I did. I lied about that.
No.
And then I would have to sneak some in with me. And like I said, the Ambien wouldn't work without booze. So I had to sneak booze in with me as well so that I could manage my own detox. That was my plan.
I know you had some medically assisted detox.
Yes.
But I've heard that it's not only a physical crisis, but it's also like a psychological crisis. Put into words what it's like?
Yeah, it's like your brain is on fire and you're searching for water to put it out. And all you can think about is, how can I get well? How can I get well? How can I get well? How can I make this feeling go away? How can I make this feeling go away? Someone described it like having like low-grade diarrhea, if you've ever had that. Like you're always kind of waiting to go to the bathroom. So you go through a conversation, but you're not thinking about the conversation. You're thinking about getting to that bathroom. that's kind of what addiction is like. And that's definitely like what withdrawal was like. Detox was like, I was just always thinking about, because I was medically detoxed, I would get drugs at certain times, medication at certain times of the day. There was like a morning dose, an afternoon dose, and an evening dose. All I was doing was thinking about those doses. That's it. Mm-hmm. And my kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And after you got out of treatment, you really expected to use again, right?
I did. That was my plan. It wasn't even just an expectation. I was just like, that was the way I talked myself into going to treatment, was that you can use again when you get out. And I thought, you know, this will be really good because maybe I just need a break so that I can, you know, take them as prescribed. And 30 days off, I wasn't able to do that on my own. And it wasn't even 30 days, right? Because they stepped me down. I was titrated down. But whatever the break was, I didn't know what I was going to get when I got there. That period of time would be enough of a break that I could use Ambien again as prescribed.
What stopped you, even though you planned to do it?
The bigger picture of what stopped me was I wanted to be in my children's lives more than I wanted anything, which is why I went to treatment. The way that I achieved that goal was because I had a divorce attorney that was extremely prescriptive. And she was like, you need to do these 12 things so that I have the best case going forward for you. And one of them was twice a week drug testing. And I was quite professional at doctor shopping and that kind of stuff and getting, you know, prescriptions from different doctors. But I wasn't truly a good junkie because I had no idea how to beat a drug test. And I didn't even know if that was going to be something that I could investigate without being caught. I was really scared of being caught, of my history on my computer being examined. And so I kind of surrendered the idea that I would be able to take anything during this period where I was getting divorced. And I went to 12-step meetings and I saw a therapist twice per week who I ended up adoring, who specialized in addiction. She was recommended by the treatment center that I went to. She ended up being incredible for me. I thought I was biding my time until divorce was settled and then I could kind of go back. But what was actually happening was all these therapies, the 12-step program, the, you know, re-engaging in my life, the therapy itself, really, you know, being a present mom, all these things were working on me. And so by the time I was kind of released 4 months later from any obligation, I continued to go.
Well, I love the way you described your divorce lawyer in the book. I could picture her.
Yes.
She's like a really good lawyer.
Yeah.
And also something else maybe we could talk a little bit about is you were going through a divorce. You went to treatment. You were already going through a divorce. Then you did something that nobody recommends. You fell in love with somebody in treatment.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't fall in love with him there, but I definitely had this connection with him
that was.
What I came away from treatment thinking was that he was my friend. Like, that's how he felt to me. Even though we had kissed twice while we were there, I thought, this can't possibly go anywhere, but he's my friend. Like, we've been through so much and we'll stay in each other's lives as friends. And then, you know, he ends up moving to Los Angeles from Utah where he is. And there's a series of events. But yeah, nobody thought it was a good idea. Everybody thought that was a terrible idea. Yeah. Certainly not in the best interest of anything I was working toward. And yet there it was.
You know, it's so interesting. I kept rooting for you, though. The way you write this book and the way you kind of let the reader into who you are, into your mind, into your intentions. I was rooting for you that whole time, for you and for him.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And then you did end up together eventually.
Yeah, we still are. We dated for about 6 years, lived separately and dated for 6 years. And then when my ex-husband and his wife moved back to town, they had been living in our Malibu house, or what was their Malibu house, but previously ours. We bought the house a few doors down from them and moved in there. And that was the first time we cohabitated.
Well, since you both struggle from substance use disorder, do you keep each other in check? Is it something that you worry about for the other?
I don't think we worry about it now. I think both of us are far enough away from it, and we're both really engaged in our recovery. It's a daily thing for me. I'm daily either with somebody that I work with in recovery or that the woman who guides me through my recovery or a recovery meeting. And he is too. He has the same kind of setup. We absolutely talk about recovery. We have a recovery meeting in our house every week. We have for the last 14 years. So we have a very sober home. We talk about recovery a lot. We don't talk about what got us here a whole lot because it's not as relevant, but keeping our recovery present and feeding it and taking care of it is what's more present.
I know your children were always on your mind, you know, when you went to treatment, when you were going through your divorce. And how did your boys fare through this and how are they doing today?
Oh, they're amazing. They're so good. So they're 25 and 23 now. You know, I talked to them before I left and when I came back. They were much more impacted by the divorce than they were me going away for 30 days and coming back and hitting meetings and all that stuff. They've grown up in this sober house, so they've been dropped off with their friends on Saturdays and kind of picked their way across the room of people meeting to discuss addiction and alcoholism and said hi and been hugged and kissed by regular meeting members. And their friends do the same thing. They go into their room or they went into their rooms and played PlayStation or Xbox. They know my story and its broad strokes. I never felt it necessary to give them details because I don't want to give them more than they've asked for that they can handle. Actually, it's not up to me to determine what they can handle, but more than they've asked for. And I went to them before the book went to first pass, which is like when you're publishing and this is the time that it goes to the copywriters, basically, like the editor and you were done and it goes to copywriters and it's hard to change anything after that as the author. And so I told them, I said, this is a book about this year where your dad and I got divorced, where my addiction was the worst, where I checked into treatment, where I met Scott. If there's anything during that time regarding you that you don't want me to talk about, I won't. If you want to read it and see if there's anything you would like changed, absolutely. And then, you know, they both just said they trusted me. They're super proud of the book. And we're really close. Like, they're here all the time. They both live separately with their girlfriends. But I see my older one basically every day. I see the younger one two or three times a week. We talk on the phone every day. And they call me, which is really unusual for people their age.
Especially boys. Yeah.
But I'm like their assistant too. So they'll call me and either ask for my advice or ask me to help them with something. And it's just really, it's a clean relationship. I'm not hiding anything from them. And we're, you know, we have family dinner every Sunday where my mom comes and my brother comes and the boys and their girlfriends come and Scott's kids come. And I'm really fortunate. I know this. I know that my situation is not typical, regardless of addiction. And I'm aware of that, and I am grateful for it all the time.
Have you lost a loved one to overdose or fentanyl poisoning? I'd like to invite you to share their story on our new Emily's Hope Memorial website called More Than Just a Number. They were our children, siblings, cousins, husbands, wives, aunts, uncles, and friends, so much more than just a number. You can submit a memorial today on morethanjustanumber.org.
What advice do you have for people who may be struggling with addiction or family members who are dealing with a loved one? Do you have advice?
Someone just called me today who I've known for years and asked me about a family member who it was just revealed that they've been going through a really debilitating addiction. And I think as a family member, and I know a little bit of this because Scotty continued to drink after I got sober, which was really painful and confusing for me.
Right.
He seemed to have it so much better than I did in treatment. I hated being there. I hated everything about it. I was planning to use and drink. And he was really set on, he felt safe there. And he wanted to stay. And then I stayed sober and he went and drank. So I didn't understand that. I think the best advice that I got was that I needed to leave it to love him in the way that I could love him and to stay out of it. You know, not try to guide his appointments, not try to arrange for things for him. You know, there are no inquisitions, no second guessing him, and to really just let him have the dignity of his own experience with this, but also letting him know that I was there and I loved him. And when he was ready, and if that time came before he went to jail or died, that I would be ready to do whatever that looked like with him. And I didn't know where I would be. Like, it could have taken him years to get sober, and I could have moved on romantically and been with somebody else. I didn't know what that looked like. But my intention at the time was to be a sober touchdown for him and continue to be that for as long as I could. And it was really, really hard. His last run was in Hawaii, run meaning drinking from bottle to bottle. And I wanted to go, you know, I wanted to go and save him. Yeah. And I didn't. I stayed here. I took care of my kids. I went to meetings, you know, doing my parent association duties. And I waited for him to call. And, you know, eventually he came back and he got sober. And it wasn't my journey. It was his.
I think those words are so profound. It wasn't your journey. It was his. I think as a parent, when you see a child struggling with something like this, it's a little bit different because you feel like you have to do something, right? And yes. I found with my daughter that I had to just love her and let go, because the more I tried to control or the angrier I got, the worse things got, the more I drove her away. Now, sadly and unfortunately, she died because of fentanyl. And I think that's what has so many parents, especially, and I'm sure spouses, friends, loved ones, worried about that person who is struggling, because they can easily die today. But there isn't some quick, easy fix or solution. You know, you can't just shake someone and get them to stop. And I think that's some of what you're writing explained to as well.
And I am so sorry for your loss. And I've been listening to your podcast. And honestly, some of the episodes are hard to get through because of the grief that I feel. I just, you know, profound sadness as a mom, as a daughter, you know, thinking about what my parents were going through, who were still alive, while I was going through all this, and their horror and their helplessness, their powerlessness. Fentanyl is a really, really scary drug, because you do not have to be an addict to die from it. You overdose from fentanyl when you try it the first time at a party. It's in a gummy. It's laced in a drink. It's really terrifying. And my kids don't seem to have what I had addiction-wise, but I have sat them both down more than once and just explained, like, yo, you can't try anything that anybody hands you. Anything. I know it's tempting and I know it's social and you're all out and it's a big deal. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it is. It is. And that is the really scary thing about what's going on with fentanyl, I think. And when someone is engaging in addictive behavior, you can be on the lookout for something like that.
Right.
But when they're not, how do you prepare?
You can't.
You know?
You can't.
You can't.
Yeah, the days of experimentation really
are gone.
We do have a lot of parents who listen to this podcast, a lot, who have children currently, you know, struggling. And I think that you really cannot control that person suffering from substance use disorder, just like you couldn't control Scott. And all you can do is continue to offer a hand, a loving hand. I think that's so important.
And take care of yourself.
And take care of yourself.
That's what I did. Right. I took care of myself. Like I said, I went to meetings. I did my workouts. I did meditations. If I had let myself go in service of worrying about him or helping him, I would have regretted that. It was counterintuitive. Every time I engaged in anything that was life-affirming for myself was counterintuitive. But I'm really glad that I didn't, and I didn't abandon myself, because I don't want to ever do that again.
Because you probably would have relapsed. Most likely.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still weird that I didn't.
Not only did Laura stay in recovery and avoid relapse, she now uses her life experiences to help others. In addition to increasing awareness about substance use disorder, Laura also has a podcast titled The Only One in the Room. We've put information about the podcast in our show notes. And while you're there checking it out, please also take a moment to give this podcast a positive review and to share it with family and friends. It helps spread our mission to raise awareness about substance use disorder and our nation's drug epidemic, which will hopefully
get more people into treatment, and save lives.
So this podcast came out of an experience I had where I was the only Black person in a room full of 600 people. And when I wrote about that experience, the article went viral and I thought, oh, Black people are going to connect with this. But what happened was it was people of all races from all over the world, all ages, all ethnicities, wrote me back and told me their only one stories and said, I know what it's like to feel alone in a room full of people. And there are these really isolating things that happen throughout our lives. And I think everybody has one. You have one.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, a stigmatized death of a child.
Yeah. But it could be as simple as, you know, I'm the only broke mom in my friend circle and my kid can't do everything that the other kids can do. You can be the only one in a wheelchair. I had one letter from a woman who was overweight. She walked into a yoga class in her neighborhood and all the thin people turned and stared at her like she had two heads. And she left and she felt like the only one in the room, you know. So these are the stories we tell on the podcast. And the object is to, one, once the person tells their story, they're instantly less alone because immediately there's feedback and people saying, me too, me too, me too, like the good Me Too movement, not the hashtag Me Too. But when, you know, when a problem is shared, there's that Swedish expression, when a problem is shared, it's halved. And that affinity, that community is the antidote for shame. Community is the antidote for isolation, obviously. And creating a community is what we try to do with the podcast, with The Only One in the Room.
No, that's very cool. And I agree. That's why I share my story, because I'm not the only one. But it feels that way oftentimes. And it certainly did at first. And as I share my story more and more and more, of course, this is the kind of deaths that we're dealing with fentanyl are so prevalent now. Nearly 110,000 people died of overdose, mostly fentanyl related in 2022, which is unbelievable to me.
It's unfathomable.
Unfathomable.
These are human beings.
Right. There are so many of us, you know, left. I was talking about the collateral damage left behind. And none of us escape collateral damage in our lives, right? From whatever blowout or whatever happens. But well, I just really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today and love it that you wrote the book and congratulations on how well it's doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. This is really important to me to come on your podcast and I appreciate you giving me this platform. It's a platform where all these really important and profound stories are shared and I'm glad that you allowed me to add my voice to it. So thank you.
Your story also important and profound as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Grieving Out Loud. You can check out more podcast episodes, find resources for help with substance use disorder, and get involved in our mission by checking out our website, emilieshope.charity. And we hope this episode offered you valuable insights and support. Stay connected with us as we release a new episode of Grieving Out Loud every Wednesday. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage. This podcast is produced by Casey Wannenberg-King and Anna Fye.